You just recorded 10 minutes of ranting without, it was completely calm. It wasn't even a rant. It sounded more boring than physics classes I took back in university just to qualify to be able to do English.
Yeah, did you notice I had the NPR voice going on too?
Oh my god, this was the most boring thing ever. You're going to kill audience from simply autodidactic, spruggery.
Welcome to the Contextual Insurgent Podcast. I'm your getting our ass chewed host, Aaron Smith, and this is again the person who is chewing my ass, Tech Bro Pido.
Nostruvia, you are welcome to my editorial content. You don't believe what you missed.
Yes, yes. I sat down and it was interesting. I got infected with the NPR virus, and I was like, hello, so let's talk about Donald Trump, and I was just like, I don't know, I was
yes, I find him very concerning, and these are reasons that I think we need to have discussion.
Well, I wasn't even like, well, that's the thing, I wasn't being never Trump, but yeah, no, it's interesting, we want to tackle the Trump question, which is the sort of thing that everyone's been wrestling with the last few weeks, especially since Herschel Walker lost his runoff against Warnock, and it's one of these things where, yeah, again, it's disappointing, the 2022 elections, and there's a lot of blame going around, and people, it's interesting because everyone's got, they're blaming shit on whatever hobby horse they happen to be on about. Like, there's some people who are blaming just the establishment Republicans, there's some people who are blaming Trump, and there's some people who are blaming whatever the fuck, election hacking, other shit. Like, everyone's got their little thing that they're getting onto. And I think it's like, I think it's a little bit of everything, that's the sort of thing. It's like, I can see arguments for all of them. And I think it's wrong to try, I think there's enough shit to go around that we shouldn't all be trying to pile it on everyone. So, but really the question here that we really want to focus mostly on here is the Trump question, which is, what is the future of Trump?
Or more specifically, instead of making it as general as that, is Donald Trump the person to be voting for, to be looking for savior, to be voting in 2024, or should you set your sights to a different person?
Yeah, again, and this is one of the things that's a radioactive topic to deal with, because it's like the people who have been, for the past few years that have even broached this at all, have usually been people that have been like fucking cucks. The people that are like the Rick Wilson types, the Lincoln Project people. And there's been a big pushback against that because you don't want to be seen as disloyal. You don't want to be seen like you're supporting those people. And that's one of the things, too, for me. It's like, I think for us, for example, that we don't have shit to prove as far as, what we've done and where we've been and the shit we've been involved with. I know
what
I don't.
Sacrificed.
Yeah, the sacrifices that I've made for this sort of stuff. I don't think I have shit to prove anymore. And it's one of those things, it's like, when you're going to be, if you want to try to be in any form of leadership, part of that is you have to be willing to, say things that may not be incredibly popular, may be a little bit controversial. But at the same time, we're not fucking Liz Cheney types, that's an important thing. It's like, that's been the problem. It's like, you don't want to be Liz Cheney, but you don't want to not be realistic about what's going on. One of the things I said, and immediately after the 2020 election, I was talking about one of the podcasts I did. I said, hey, folks, it's okay. And I was talking about the things that that I thought went really well, and the good sign, the positive signs I saw in the election. And I said, look, we knew this day was going to come regardless eventually. Like one day, Trump has at most 8 years as president. And he's like in his late 70s, he's not going to live forever. So at some point, one way or the other, Trump is going to be, out of the picture. And we have to build something that can continue after that. And this is really something, this is something Tech Bro, you should know about this. This is something that tech people deal with. It's the succession problem. Like what comes next? Who comes after the genius CEO? We saw this with Apple's kind of scene that had this issue. Steve Jobs died. And I guess Tim Cook has done a decent-ish job, but But most people that love Apple have said, like, you know, Apple's not really as innovative as it was.
Well, it's a different company altogether. Instead of innovating, creating new products, bringing people in, dragging into platform, it's now they're defending walled garden, defending market share, more defensive position, as opposed to sort of opening new markets.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's like, you know, Steve Jobs left Apple in an amazing position. And, you know, Steve Jobs was like this very innovative person, and I feel like Tim Cook is less innovative, but he's much more about
iterative.
Yes, he's less innovative and more iterative, because he's got, hey, we've got the model here, we just need to continually refine it. And you know, I've been disappointed with some of the Apple products. Anyway, we're not talking about Apple faggery or whatever, but yeah. So Trump, what do you think? Where what's your situation?
So again, big question, and this is there was a couple good points you brought up in 10 minutes of just most you know. Art, fart smelling thing.
Hello, welcome to NPR.
When did you start supporting Donald Trump?
Welcome to the Contextual Insurgent Project.
Right. When did you start supporting Donald Trump?
I started supporting Trump in September of 2015.
Right. And this was because why?
Well, he was saying the right stuff. You know, he was talking about immigration, trade, and war, which are three big topics. You know, Trump was getting up there saying, you know, the Iraq war was wrong.
Specifically, he said that it was wrong, and that it was a mistake. Actually basically managed to expose everyone. No one else was willing to say that. So, you know, I have different take. I don't like America as superpower. I don't like America as hyperpower dominating world politics, doing this kind of thing. I don't believe in this imperialism. So I, frankly, supported, I supported because I didn't think any Democrats were going to wind down the American empire. I supported Rand Paul initially because he sounded like you read the policy papers, you read the positions. He sounded like the inheritor of his father. His father, of course, being sort of the I'd say the first memed anti-war president talking about U.S. blowback and foreign policy. I can make all these intellectual arguments for it, but by October, it became very, very clear to me that while my head and my policy papers and my analysts said, well, then, you know, the logical position arrived at through you know, libertarian policy, white papers, blah, 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 is Rand Paul. My heart said Donald Trump is going to stomp this guy. I watched Donald Trump on all seasons of Apprentice. Yes, I do have common touch. As much as I may be communist, as much as I may be tech person, I've watched every single season of Apprentice, enjoyed it. I followed Donald Trump's career my entire life. Very entertaining man. And my heart knew this man was going to stomp everyone like Godzilla.
Yeah, he.
And by October, I could no longer deny it. I sort of knew this around September. I said, unless he flames out, this is Godzilla.
Yeah, for me, it was like I started paying attention to what he was saying. Like almost immediately, because he was saying the right things, he was saying the right things on the right topics. The guy was very hardcore about talking about closing the border and, you know, bringing a lot of industrial stuff home, which is something that's huge. And that we're seeing more of this, especially in the last couple of years, as like COVID happened and, the divisions have widened between a lot of the rival powers in the world. People are bringing, like, there's a chip plant here in Arizona now. They're building a massive Taiwanese semiconductor chip plant here, which is, you know, holy fuck, you know, maybe we shouldn't have, like, the critical chip production for the world on, like, an island off of, like, China, who says, we're going to take this fucking island and fuck anyone who doesn't like it. Maybe that's a bad idea, you know? It's like, it's one of those things. It's like, the last couple of years has been like, holy shit, you know, globalism really works well and everyone likes each other, and there's one big power that runs everything. But now it's like, holy shit, you know, if there's like rival powers and people aren't getting along, this isn't so cool anymore. At least like on paper for the upper middle class type, the PMC, professional managerial class people. Because yeah, even over globalism the last decade or so, there, like, it's been incredibly destructive to a lot of the real economy people, the flyover country people, you know. And that's really what attracted a lot of people to Trump. But yeah, you know, Trump said all this good stuff, and I was like, holy shit, the dude's saying the right things about the right topics. I'm not super, you know, it's Trump saying him. It was really Trump himself that took me a little while, because I always kind of thought of him as a clown. And, you know, he got standing up there saying these right things and sticking to him. And that was the big thing for me. It's like, I'm like, fuck yeah, Trump's the, you know, regardless of everything else, it's like the guy who's saying the things that I've always wanted someone to say and support is actually doing this shit. I was like, yeah, I've got to get on with this, you know? And yeah, it's like, again, you know, this was stuff like, you know, I was in the Bay Area then, and it's like, everyone, like, the shit I had to experience, because, you know, you're being a right-wing Trump supporter in the Bay Area, all the stuff, all the shit that cost me, and all the stuff I had to deal with, and, you know, being at all the rallies and riots up and down the West Coast, I, you know, yeah, so, no, I have paid a price for all of this, you know, and I don't regret it. I think it was knowing what, like, you know, that's the thing, it's like, it's always very, you have to be very careful never to look back at things that you know now and try to apply that to what you knew then. Because, you know, the America of what we thought it was in 2016 was a different universe. I mean, this was like the world and America was something totally different. So I'm trying to avoid dropping my NPR. So why don't you jump in here and yell some more?
So, you know, to boil down the topic of this podcast, really it came down to this. Is Donald Trump the person we need to look to for 2024? Do we need to look to DeSantis? Do we need to look to some other savior? And okay, I will be person that drops dead cat in the room because I don't care. Or Kanye 24. Or Gay 24. You know, with all the baggage that goes with it. As we said, this is going to be a controversial podcast. The thing for me is this. I think people, you know, look at Donald Trump and are having this discussion. This is 2022. Let me repeat. We are still in 2022. We just had midterms, called midterms. Now, you know, presidential election really does get started, you know, in 2023, yes, and we're nearly 2023. But remember, Donald Trump emerges on Golden Escalator, September 2015.
It was June
2015. So that was June 2015. He makes appearances and all these kinds of stuff. And then he starts, you know, you support him October, or you support him September, I have supported him October. But, you know, this thing is, this happens. We are several months ahead of cycle, and while things on cycle have been moving forward, there's an important thing to understand about Donald Trump. Everyone else had announced. He's sort of late the party, as it were. But that's because, as has been noted before, Donald Trump is called counter-puncher. Donald Trump, quite simply, has made his name as being man of moment, okay? When he revitalizes Trump Plaza, when he does the ice skating rink that he delivers under budget, ahead of schedule, it's because everyone else had failed. And they only fail, and the only way that everyone else had failed is everyone else had bite at Apple, everyone else had presented a proposal. Donald Trump then appears late to the party and says, all of you suck, I'm going to do this, it's going to be fantastic, it's going to be beautiful, it's going to be the greatest ice skating rink ever. And he does it. So I think one of the things is trying to make Donald Trump into a conventional politician who runs on platform, runs ahead of time, is establishment, not dark horse, but, you know, whatever, white horse, light horse, leading horse, fan favorite. That is a position that he's not used to and not very good at. So I think ultimately, interesting thing, again, this is controversial, not going to go into perhaps most controversial parts of Yay 24, but I think the thing to understand about Kanye is he represents very similar energy, or Ye as it is. Ye represents very similar energy, okay? You know, you probably most remember him if you're not a big hip-hop fan, of him, you know, interrupting at the Tony, whatever, the award ceremony.
The Grammys, I think.
The Grammys, with Taylor Swift. He gets up on stage, takes microphone from her, tells her, I'm gonna let you finish, but, you know, your video shouldn't have won. You know, Beyonce's was one of the best videos ever. Okay, he takes the microphone. Oh, but that's just crazy kind of thing, and he's clearly going crazy right now. Well, I don't know. He was a guy who was hosting with Mike Myers during Hurricane Katrina relief fund, and he says, just blatantly, he says, George W. Bush doesn't care about black people. And Mike Myers looks at him like, what? I'm a comedian. I react to things. I'm funny. I have very quick reactions. I'm dumbfounded. This is Mike Myers. Austin Powers.
Yeah, his face is so hilarious. He turns and looks, and like he has like no, he doesn't know how to respond.
There's
to that.
Nothing in his bag of tricks as a comedian to do, which is amazing. So the thing is, Ye has always been inflection point to change conversation about things. And in fact, you want to look at the impact on politics that Ye had. George W. Bush has gone on record saying the worst part of his presidency. Remember, he is there reading, My Pet Goat to elementary school students when Twin Towers are hit in Florida. Okay? He is president over first significant, attack on American soil. On American soil, and you can say Pearl Harbor, but that was not that was American soil in military base. So then you can talk about Beirut or whatever.
It wasn't even really a state then.
Yeah, wasn't a state. It was not a state at point. It was, and then you could talk about, so it's first attack on American soil really since 1812, I would put it as. George W. Bush said his worst moment of presidency was Ye saying that he didn't care about black people. Worse than 9/11. Worse than armored gate on Humvees. Worse than everything that turned out with Iraq War. Worse than Hurricane Katrina. Worse, the actual thing that Ye was complaining about, and the deaths and all that, the flooding of American City. Worse than the 2008 financial crisis. No, he said the worst thing was being said he didn't care about black people by a hip-hop artist. So, I think it's, you need to take context to look at what Ye has done. Ye has impacted, award shows. He's impacted politics at the presidential level going on, a decade now. A decade plus. This is underappreciated about the man. So the thing is, I think Ye is representing the counterpuncher energy, the kind of inflection point energy, and what's being missed about Ye 24 is what has been said explicitly, is that Ye, at least initially, wanted to get into this not to run for president. And this is what Fuentes and Yiannopoulos, I think Fuentes was saying, though, is to push Trump more to the right and to show him not to throw his base under the bus. Ye got in there, and you know what he did? He managed to get Donald Trump to speak out about January 6th electoral justice protesters. He managed to get them to talk out and say he would issue a pardon, and furthermore, he wouldn't just issue pardon for them. He said that he'd actually look at doing at significant compensation of whatever that means. I'm not sure if he meant economic or whatever, but he said that. Ye managed to get him to say that, and we're trying to walk back that. Donald Trump does walk back things you can't walk back, but that is what Ye has already done in conversation. This is overshadowed by people wanting to talk about, Marjorie Taylor Greene space lasers, and about music industry, and Harley Pasternak, and controllers. Everyone wants to talk about the juicy things, but he managed to get significant concession about January 6th protesters.
Yeah, it's one of those things is, and I don't even know, I don't even know how much Ye is, planning stuff. I almost kind of think, Ye is one of those people, I don't want to merely dismiss him as being mentally ill, but I do think that probably plays a large part, and maybe some of that was what, his trainer did to him, because he was talking about being drugged and stuff, and his trainer, he was sharing text messages from his trainer that was threatening to have him drugged again. So there's lots of crazy shit like that. So I think Ye is probably a little bit off his rocker, but I think at the same time, it's a purely instinctive level. I think he's operating at a really instinctive level. He's almost a fucking antenna for the zeitgeist.
Quite frankly, I think is as much as things shattered consensus reality as far as things go. He is the one surfing the Kali Yuga now. Donald Trump is now is essentially establishment, and he's still an establishment people don't like. Ye is acting essentially as the Kool-Aid man that Donald Trump acted as in 2015.
Yeah, no, I can kind of see that. I don't think Ye has a shot, anything close to a shot of winning, but I think there's topics like that where I think he's definitely pushed Trump on. That's just kind of that whole topic is oh God. I watched the Alex Jones video, the Netanyahu thing, and I can't stop laughing. Because it's he's got the Balenciaga mask on, and he's woohoo, he's got the weird voice thing going on, and it's
Well, he doesn't have weird voice going on. He puts weird voice on for Net and Yoohoo.
Net,
I like to kill people! I'm going to kill people!
That was the funniest thing. Alex Jones is sitting there what the fuck? When you have Alex Jones sitting there hey guys, let's just calm down. Let's not be crazy. Let's not say crazy shit. It's that's the funniest fucking thing. Anyway. We're worried. We're talking about the Trump question. So now we got on Ye, because Ye is like, that was, we need to do an episode talking about Ye. Like, that was the funniest fucking thing. Like,
we could do a review of it. It's, I think, again, I have different perspective than you as far as things go. But yes, you know, back to the Trump question. I think very simply these. People are looking for Donald Trump to sort of be a strong leader, to be standard bearer, to be good sort of diplomatic politician that holds things up, to be essentially a Hillary Clinton, a stable, you know, a standard bearer of her party, or to be, you know, a Mitt Romney or a John McCain, who are stable as far as positions go. And John McCain was known as Maverick, but, you know, he's going to want to go to war, bomb Iran, whatever, wants to go to war in Ukraine, wants to go to war everywhere. You know, there's a stability to him, even though he's quote-unquote Mr. Maverick or whatever. The point is, I don't think Donald Trump does well as such, and it, you know, quite frankly, and this, I would say perhaps most acute failure of Donald Trump, the succession plan, right, is not essentially investing in someone as to be his public policy person, to be the straight man. You know, Abbott and Costello were a comedic pair of early film, and it worked by one of them being very very boring and still, or like Penn and Teller's better example. You have Penn, who's being silly and telling stuff and all that. Teller is silent during entire act. He's silent and he's acting like a very stiff, non-comedic kind of person. And this kind of interplay works. Donald Trump does Penn Jillette magician type energy very well. But to push off against things, he's knocked down enough, and there's no one willing to stand to be his teller, because they're afraid of him attacking him for good reason. Donald Trump, frankly, needed to get someone to stand up and to sort of represent the straight man position of the teller position, of this is what, you know, Donald Trump stands for and stuff like that. Then Donald Trump can come and modify it a bit. That is what he needed, and that is what he's lacking. But I still think there's plenty of time for him to do such a thing, but that's what he needs. And frankly, I think, you know, the discussion around Ron DeSantis is that DeSantis is very much the straight man, very much not interesting, very much not funny, very much lacking the charisma and the timing and the same sort of star power of both whether Trump, Ye, whoever you want to name, or even Obama, as far as it goes, you may dislike, but, you know, he still captivated people. People still turned out for those rallies. He lacks that quality. But I think he knows that. I think he knows that. And instead of trying to do that, he makes policy announcements. He has other surrogates do things for him. And so that's his strength. He knows his weakness, and he compensates for it. Whereas I don't think Donald Trump has really imbibed his weaknesses and fully compensated enough for them.
Yeah, I think one thing that, you know, and it's really interesting, because one of the things people don't touch on as much as they need is, like, a lot of the things that Trump said were almost like a Benedict option, like in the sense of he was saying things that were outrageous, and it proved his loyalty, because, you know, if you got the Iraq war was a mistake, you know, and like trashing all these other people, like he was saying the shit people, like there's a contingent of Americans that feel absolutely beat down, and they wanted Trump because he would get up there and say the things, he would punch down on the people that punched down on them, and that's a huge part of it. That's a huge part of it. And we can't overlook that.
Well, what other tool could have destroyed? I mean, it seems so far away, but what other tool could have destroyed Bush legacy?
Yeah, you know, it's like the Bush dynasty is wrecked. The Cheney dynasty is wrecked. You know, it's there's lots of people that are like fucking. You know, he wrecked a lot of these people that needed wrecking. And that's a huge thing. It's like a lot of people are happy for that because they saw Trump actually stand up for them. Well, publicly stand up for them and defy a lot of these other people in politics. And that's a huge thing that people have to, you know.
Anyone recognize. That wants to be anti-Donald Trump to me, I say, go look a veteran missing his legs in eyes and tell him, you know what, I wish we still had neocons in charge that would send more young men to suffer injuries you suffered. I have nothing but contempt, revilement, and would personally send to the wall myself. These pieces of crap that want to condemn more Americans to foreign wars, to lose limbs, and say that it's better to have that than to have a crude orange man in charge of country.
No, that's a great point. Like, I agree with you on that. And that's the sort of thing, and that's really kind of where we are as far as the crossroads that we're facing. It's like, you know, the whole thing is like I agree with what Trump wanted, And I agreed, like, he said the things that I wanted, and he talked about the policy positions that I wanted, and he was willing to fight for that. But, like, what do I want as a voter here? It's like, I want Donald Trump, but I want Donald Trump that's ruthless and competent and is able to surround himself with loyal people. That's what I want. And maybe Donald Trump will be that. Maybe he will learn and be that. Or maybe there's someone else out there. I'm still undecided. Maybe there's someone else out there that can be that, you know, or at least, you know, we've learned a lot from the last 6 years. I think we need to take the lessons from that.
Right. Well, it's again, for me, anger comes about that Donald Trump is a wrecking ball. Donald Trump is Samson option. Donald Trump is an imperfect vessel, certainly. Samson falls to Delilah, gives into his lust and all this, and is told never to let his hair be cut. He lets his hair be cut. At that point, they then gouge his eyes out and to restrain him and make him a laughingstock for years. They forget his strength and all this. They leave him behind and think that he's a joke. He's a has-been who has nothing left to him. He has his eyes gouged out and all this. And so they leave him to a dungeon to his fate, as it were. His hair then eventually grows out, bringing back the strength. You know, he then is at, you know, finds at a critical juncture that he's walking, you know, through a temple, if I recall correctly, and there's two load-bearing columns that are within arm's reach of each other, and Samson, of course, is literally possessed of Herculean strength. He then seizes these columns, pushes them apart, collapses the temple, killing himself and killing his captors and everyone involved. This is Samson. This is a sort of Samson. Issue is, Donald Trump may be a Samson. He may be Samson option as far as things go. But the thing is, as I said, what disgusts me is that people knew that Donald Trump was flawed man, and yet for all the assurances of mature adults and the policy people and intelligence of people on the right or Republicans, as it were, there was no one there to pick up. There was no organized libertarian kind of thing willing to seize upon Trump energy. Call it the Rand Ron Paul caucus, saying, you know what, anti-war president, first really anti-war president, we're going to build upon this. Yes, there was no reach out to the Cold Pink, to the Mondo Weiss, to the antiwar.com. There was no reach out to that, to those libertarians, the Paleocon and left wing factions as well, to reach out and say, you know what, imperfect, but only one that could actually stop war machine because it was underestimated and actually put it, good job. There was no one willing to step up and no one willing to put machinery in place to not try to replace, but to support and support surrogate candidates and do this. So the thing is, it exposes weakness, really, of organization of people that can fill such things in. And so the thing is, Donald Trump destroyed in his wake. He didn't build. And, you know, I guess you could say, you could fault Donald Trump for not building, and you can say that he made his career as a builder, and so he didn't build. These might be fair criticisms to level, but anyone that expected people to be able to follow Donald Trump, except in a personality cult, didn't understand what Donald Trump was. And so the issue I have is that there's been no real movement that's been allowed to cohere to immigration, trade, and war. There's been no real caucuses, no real organization that isn't some grift operation, or isn't some attempt to just take more money and to adopt the flag in this kind of position one way, and then to use it to destroy on others and all that. This is the problem. You can look to people like Tom Cotton, you can look to others like this, but, you know, Tom Cotton, we may seize upon American production for trade, but he's going to use it for war. He wants war. He's hungry for war as far as these things are. I don't believe he's going to stop that, okay? There's no one perfect, and I guess my frustration is that Donald Trump was a wrecking ball, and no one, despite all the assurances of right, of how intelligent the right was, there was no organization or people willing to take over and sweep up and build in debris or build in a wreckage of Trump along those lines.
Yeah, it's one of the things I said in one of the first podcasts I did immediately after the 2020 election. I was like, look, we knew this day was coming. I was like, look, there's lots of good signs here from this. I see lots of positive things from overall from the election. Of course, there's negative downsides. I voted for Trump for another term, and I don't regret it. I think he deserved it. And I think what happened to him was bullshit. And I said, look, one of the things that we knew this day was coming. Like, we knew that one day or another, like, Trump had at most 8 years in office. He's an old man, and like, he's not going to live forever. So we know we have a period of time at which Trump, we're going to have to build something. that will succeed him. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs at Apple had the same issue. Like, he needed a succession plan. He needed some way to carry on after him. The part of a leader is being able to not just build the things that you want, smash the things that you don't want, but build something to replace it, and then set a system in place that will carry on after you. And, you know, that's one of the things that we really need to wrestle with. It's like, you know, I want Trump. I want a Trumpian figure who is ruthless. Like, I thought Trump was way, like, I thought he was nice in the sense of, like, he didn't follow through on a lot of stuff he should have. I want Trump who's ruthless. I want a Trump who's competent. And I want Trump who hires loyal, competent people. That's one of the things that frustrates me about his administration, was that, you know, he hired competent people and he hired loyal people, but they weren't the same people. You know, it's like the competent people that he had were incredibly disloyal, and the loyal people he had were incredibly incompetent. I don't know. I can take that back. I know a handful of Trump appointees that were loyal and competent, but the ones I personally know.
How high up were they, though?
They were not the actual White House. They were not the tippy top.
So yeah. I think issue becomes that frankly what was necessary, and I'm well aware of audience, I'm well aware of your background, and I'm well aware that this is not going to be most most looked up to example to point to, but I think this is where a Lincoln-like leadership is necessary, which is willing to appoint and then fire people and willing to cycle through generals until you find your General Grant, who may be a drunkard, who may be imperfect, who may do these things, but he's frankly willing to sacrifice Union soldiers to grind down the destroy enemy to accomplish goals. I think that what was necessary. And, you know, I reading other coverage on this, Donald Trump can be very disloyal to people that have been with him for a while, but he also doesn't like firing people, too. He does it, he doesn't like it, he hangs on for too long. I think, quite frankly, what he needed to do was he needed to find someone that he actually truly trusted, which has been a problem, too, which is the attack on his inner circle. So to be fair, that's also part of it, too, taking out Paul Manafort, taking out his lawyer and all this. It's to make people scared. But what he needed to do is he needed to find a ride-or-die, truly competent person that he could both truly trust, you know, a ride-or-die person he could truly trust that was competent, that would be willing to hire fire, until he found someone that was both willing to do what was necessary and to do it effectively.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, he did fire a bunch of people, and a lot of people quit. And I think one of the things is, you know, the people that he didn't fire were ones that, you know, like, he can be weirdly sentimental and loyal to certain people. So, you know, it's like, yeah, like, he had lots of people involved in the administration that I didn't think much of. The thing with that is, with Trump really is, he made, like, we, you know, and this is really what makes it so difficult to have a discussion around this, is because it's become such a polarizing subject. Because to talk about a lot of these things, most of the people who were, or I should say anyone for a big chunk of his administration, anyone who said, the only people who wanted to speak badly about certain parts or characteristics of Trump was the turbo never Trump Lincoln Project type assholes. And of course, you don't want to be mistaken with those people. So it's been one of those areas where it's been so polarized that it's very, very difficult to have any sort of nuanced conversation around, you know, Trump and what he was able to accomplish and the people, like some of his choices and everything like that. It's extremely difficult to discuss it because it's a thing that requires a very nuanced discussion, and, you know, it's not an area that's in, you know, American general has been so polarized now that it's hard to have nuanced discussions on anything, but especially like with Trump, if you're on the right. And I think, you know, it's important to discuss some of these issues. And I think I can do that because I, you know, for me, it's like, I'm so sick of these fucking grifters. Like, so many of these people that want to, some of these folks, you see them and they say shit that gets people wound up because they want them to send them money. And this is one of the things I hate about the right, is there's so many of them. And they're not, like, at least a lot of the ones on the left are fairly competent, but they're not on the right. And that is one of my biggest criticisms of Trump, is, like, he didn't really, you know, he didn't really have any way. Like, there's a lot of these mid-level grifters that just glommed onto him and around him and onto the MAGA movement. And these fucking people are wildly incompetent, and they literally don't believe in anything, and they'll say whatever it says as long as people send them money. Holy shit. Like, that's so frustrating. But yeah, you know, I that's what I want. It's like, we have to be like, you know, the last couple of years, like, I've been disappointed in some of Trump's choices. Like, you know, I think I worry that a lot of the shit, again, the bullshit that they put him through, completely unjustified. You know, the positive side of that is we now know what we're really facing. Like, the monster has been fully revealed. And for that alone, I think Trump's been invaluable. Like, his service was invaluable. Like, I appreciate his service as president. I think he made, you know, and this goes back to the midterms, which were very disappointing, and people are blaming it on multiple things. Like, some people are blaming it all on Trump. Some people are blaming it on the establishment, and some people are blaming it on hacked elections, and whatever topic people are blaming it on is very much driven by where that person stands. It's all very self-serving. And the truth is, I can see, I think a little bit of all of that had, you know, part to do with it. I think in Arizona, you know, what happened in Maricopa, which I witnessed personally, I think that ended up being in practice voter suppression. I think the issues with the printers, like, it definitely impacted turnout. Like, I am 110% convinced that Abe Hamadeh would be, that if the printers had worked, Abe would be the attorney general elect. I don't know if it would have quite, you know, helped Carrie Lake over the line. I don't know. I think that election would have been a lot closer. Unfortunately, I think the printers, I don't think it was enough for Blake Masters, who was my favorite candidate of all of them. But yeah, you know, and I think, like, you know, Herschel Walker, and that's one of the things we have to face is, like, you know, we have to be realistic about politics. You know, like, you know, I ran for state senate in 2020 in California. I knew I wasn't going to win. Let's just be realistic. I was running as a Republican in San Francisco. That's not going to happen. But, you know, part of doing that when you're outnumbered like that is you do get to push the conversation. You do get to challenge the status quo. Because one of the things is, if it's so, when the Dem, whatever party has a lock on like that, they get very lazy and sloppy because they don't have to actually work for it. So, yeah, you know, I got to go. I didn't run on a MAGA platform. Like, I mean, I just was like, I'm going to run on the stuff that I think is relevant locally. Like, I was running against the AB5, which was the bill that makes independent contractors into employees. I was running against that because the California wrote a disastrous bill. Like, it was impacting independent writers and journalists and stuff. It was just crazy. I was running against that. Revoke that bill. I wanted to retain the rights of independent workers and contractors to remain independent contractors. I was also running against, for the housing issue, I was running against, there's the NIMBY YIMBY thing. Like, they need housing in San Francisco and the Bay Area and California in general, but I was running on more of a CEQA, which is the California environmental regulation stuff. Like, there's ways in there that you can basically hamstring. I was basically running on CEQA reform, California Environmental Qualities Act, which is a thing that most of the shutting down of building happens from. I wanted to protect a lot of independent, I wanted to protect the rights of local cities to set their own policies, but also reform the state laws that cause a lot of the obstruction. And then I was also supporting, like I was talking about, nuclear power. I was like, that was my way of being able to dodge the environmental, like, the climate change topic. Like, I say, look, you know, let's all get into these new generations of modular nuclear power that's going to be more robust power grid, all this sort of stuff. So I ran on these three different things, which are kind of orthogonal to being MAGA. And, like, I got, like, 11% of the vote, you know, which is good for San Francisco, believe it or not. One of the guys, there was the guy who was running against Nancy Pelosi, who was also on our, you know, on our GOP committee, the central committee, and he ran on a straight-up MAGA platform, and I think he got, like, 7%. You know, and that's part of the thing. It's just that difference there of, like, getting, like, 40% more votes than the real, like, he raised like $8 million or something like that. He raised millions of dollars.
You raised $1 million, though, right?
No, I raised like probably like $3,000 or $4,000. I didn't raise much. Cause I was like, I wasn't going to go out there and chill for that, too. That's part of it. I knew I wasn't going to win. Like, here's another thing, too. Let's talk about this part. Like, he ran on a cookie-cutter MAGA platform against Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco. But another thing that happens, too, is so much of this stuff is about, I've talked about this before, it's about, like, grifting. Because what happens is when you raise money as a politician, as a candidate, the people that raise money for you keep 65% of what they raise. So if someone ever calls you on the phone, hey, I'm raising money for so-and-so campaign, or you get an email or something like that on it, the candidate gets a fraction of that. So that's a huge part of that shit.
Throw in another part of it. What happens with mm-hmm. electoral fundraising, with fundraising?
Yeah, you get to start your own little groups, and you can actually charge, like, you know, like you can charge all your, like, your like, you basically, a lot of these people start like little consulting firms on the side, and they funnel the money through their consulting firm, or they charge like
to a food family member.
Yeah, family member. Yeah, like it's
so just... you put the family member on. But mm-hmm. additionally, there's another thing. Say that 60% goes to consultants, as it were, and so then there's still whatever 35% or 40% left, and all that. Well, so interesting thing. The way Gavin Newsom, this is inside baseball of California mm-hmm. politics. The way Gavin Newsom became governor of California is a really interesting story. People don't have memory of goldfish. So this is an important point. Gavin Newsom was actually going to be running against Kamala Harris. Both of them were angling for governor. Both, you know, California politics up to this point had been dominated by just Asia boomers. You had Barbara Boxer, you know, a senator. You have Dianne Feinstein, who's still there, a senator. And then you had Jerry Brown, who'd been like Governor Moonbeam. He'd been senator. He'd been like governor back in like the 80s or something like that. He'd returned for governor for two terms and all this. Basically, all big electoral offices were locked up in California. So what happens was, finally, the governor's spot opens up. Both Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom wanted it. So issue became, who's going to win? Well, what Gavin Newsom did year before, really interesting, is he sponsored a gun control initiative. I believe it was Proposition 65, if I recall correctly. It had to do with modern sporting rifles or semi-automatic rifles regulating these. This was another way to actually attack one of his rivals in California Senate. This was California Senate President Kevin De Leon. He was going to pass legislation against modern sporting rifles or semi-automatic rifles. Well, Gavin Newsom said, you know, as a lieutenant governor, you know, not much power to have as a lieutenant governor. You can't do anything. What he does is he sponsors an initiative process to try to get voters to vote for their own initiative, further restricting semi-automatic weapons. What he does is he raises, millions upon millions of dollars with it. He ends up not spending $5 million of this, okay? So all that kind of stuff you said, yeah. $5 million left over. Well, what do you do with it, right? I mean, this is, you know, do you get to keep it in your bank account? No. California, you know, electoral reform, federal electoral reform has made sure you cannot just put it in your pocket. What you can do, though, is you can stuff it into a political account to use for later political campaigns. So what happened was, Gavin Newsom, you know, before the governor race even opened up, had $5 million in his account. And basically what his you know, people said to Kamala Harris is in, you know, behind the scenes, is they said, we have $5 million starting off with. We are going to crush you. We're going to do these things. We're going to make it terrible for you. If you run for senator, however, we will really support you, do everything to make it possible. This is how Kamala Harris became a California senator, and then, of course, then went on to become vice president from this. But so the other thing, too, is basically if you can become a perpetual candidate because you can continue to raise money, and as long as you don't spend the money, you end up with an electoral advantage. And so you start off ahead of the race because you basically start off, you know, with a 100-foot head start of a foot race before every single race.
No, yeah, that's a good point. Like, there's so many games you can play with fundraising, and that's one of the things too. If you see someone, so many of these people, like, you know, there's been a tendency to nationalize campaigns and try to run a cookie cutter MAGA Donald Trump campaign across the country, and it doesn't work that way. Like, that's the reality, is, you know, politics really is local. You just can't cookie cutter like that and clone it. You've got to try to adjust it for the people that you're running to represent. And, you know, that's one of the things I think that has hurt. Yeah, you know, so that's really where we are now. It's like, you know, we have to look at, you know, Trump, and like, what is he, does he have the will he be able, because I don't think Trump has the mojo right now. So the question is, will he be able to regain it? And that's really, really the sort of thing we're going to have to see. You know, will there be a MAGA, will there be someone who comes along that is basically Trump, except he's ruthless and competent and has loyal subordinates? Is there someone out there like that? I mean, there may be some. Like, I can think of some potential candidates, and I'm still kind of in a wait and see mode, you know. But I think these are the things that we have to start wrestling with, the questions that we cannot simply keep dodging.
Well, I one more point, at least of my take, right? Obviously, historical failure of Republicans this cycle, as I saw Ann Coulter tweeted out today. She tweeted out, "Thank you, Donald Trump," replying to someone pointing out that not since 1934 has a sitting president not lost a single senator in midterm elections, and yet, Biden is the first person since FDR to not lose a single senator from his party as a sitting president. So this is something, again, this is this is nearly 80-year precedent. 90-year precedent, basically nearly 90 years precedent. It hadn't happened 90 years, it happened again. That basically, so this is historic. This is historically weak results, basically, for incumbent party, for what would be Democratic Party. There's many ways to look at it, and there should be many analyses of it. But I think way to look at it is this. I think that, frankly, what happened is Donald Trump represented three issues, and this is a discussion we had before. He represented immigration, trade, and war. So everyone has gone hard on immigration, and there's us and them. It is now an issue. It's a nationalized issue. People do take a position on it, and it hasn't been made fully settled either way, but it at least is an issue now. Trade is a major issue that I think Donald Trump basically managed to win on, basically. Everyone agrees, the building of the semiconductor plant that we can go see construction if we want to today, and wander by, meet construction workers, talk with them. Like, this is win. Everyone agreed that, Donald Trump had point on trade. No one is saying that we need to globalize trade networks, especially after COVID. So the third thing, though, war. No one's really taken up that mantle. Frankly, I think that is the unexploded ordnance. I think that is the still salient option, and that is still the thing that people don't want to touch and do things on. You look at public sentiment. It is starting to trend against more intervention, more weapons to Ukraine, and all this. And there's very few people representing this kind of anti-intervention, or maybe we need to wind down, or maybe we need to say what our limits are and not, commit blank checks, both in military aid, as well as actually willing to go all the way, to actual war with Russia. No one has touched upon that yet, and I think that if, frankly, you had a Trumpkin candidate in midterms that said, "This is bullshit war. This is bullshit. This is not costing Americans stuff. This is risking nuclear war. We don't need this. This is stupid. We need diplomacy. We need adults at table, not warmongering assholes."
Yeah, I think that's something that we need. That's the weakest thing that we, you know, the other two topics I think we've seen significant movement on. Is it as much as I want? No. Is it, you know, with the war thing is the one I think we need the biggest. We still have the biggest remaining movement that needs to be made on it. So it's really interesting, and it's hard to, again, it's one of those things that it's hard to talk about this sort of stuff because. Because anything, you know, any critique of Trump on any particular area has for too long been treated as, you know, as a rebuke of Trump or as a rebuke of ever supporting. It's basically, if you're like, hey, you know, I don't like what Trump did here, or he fell short here, or here's his flaws or failings, the default assumption has been like it's an admission that ever supporting Trump was a mistake. And I don't think that. I'm never going to think that because I don't think it was. I don't regret anything. Like my biggest critiques of Trump have really been, you know, not being aggressive enough that he needed to, not having enough comp, not being better at hiring competent people.
Not being the Trump that we expected the Trump to be.
Yeah,
Not
you
being enough
know,
Trump to
yeah,
quote
he wasn't
Anton.
the Trump that, like, I wanted Trump to be the Trump that he promised, and
The
not,
we
yeah.
need more Trump. We needed Trump to be more Trump.
Yeah, basically, yeah. That's really my critique of him. And that's really the sort of thing. It's like, you know, yeah, it's like I like in 2020 was disappointing with him too, because I just kind of felt like he was getting, like, you know, he was just, he would rather tweet when cities are burning and, you know, getting low-key threatened with a coup, which is bullshit. You know, when they had, like, Mattis and the other folks basically said, you know, they published that letter that kind of low-key threatened a coup if he tried to send, you know, the military in to put down the riots. Like, that sort of stuff. Like, doing, like, he just basically, I could sense it through all of 2020 where, you know, he's getting tested and he's failing every time that he's being tested. You know, I'm like, dude, Trump, you need to crush these fucking people. And I'm not even talking about the rioters, which, you know, he should have sent in, you know, when the governors refused to do anything, he should have sent in, like, Tom Cotton wrote the letter in the New York Times about sending the troops. And I was like, yes, you need to do that. And I'm like, even with that, you know, he's got people that are,
well,
he's getting repeatedly cucked and not doing anything.
Imagine if you know, beyond that, he managed to have a competent lawyer draft things saying that these riots are you know, clearly impending danger to electoral intimidation. They're clearly trying to create electoral interference, pointing to whatever, you know, amount of foreign funding you could do the same way FBI done for Twitter, saying that essentially this is threat to electorate, that if you're going to riot over one dead guy with possible counterfeit bills, you know, high on fentanyl, if you're going to riot over that, clearly you're going to have the same people who've already spent getting their reps in over the summer. They're clearly going to do the same thing in November. This is clearly electoral intimidation, and we're going to shut it down with the same kind of security apparatus you've seen with January 6th and other things like that. This is what was necessary. And I say this with full backing of being, you know, being communist dictator.
I mean, it pisses me off. So, like, you know, and this is one of the things where I started talking about this in 2018 or so, because I think people were not expecting what was coming. Like, they didn't fully understand the nature of the enemy. And they were just kind of like, we're still in the America of old. You know, they still sort of believed in procedures and process. And it's like, what pisses me, and this is the thing that I would say, this is what pisses me off the most about Trump, is that, you know, he rolled over, and, like, the bullshit of the last 2 years, like, these fucking people were always going to do this. Like, they were always going to go ham on everyone. Like, these lunatics, like, you know, like, he just completely fucking cucked out and, like, let these people roll over, steamroll him and everyone else. Like, he ultimately failed. And that's what pisses me off, is that Trump wasn't hard enough. You know, and, like, that's really, like, I don't think voting for him was a mistake, and so that's really what I'm looking for, is, no, I don't want a fucking rhino like Jeb Bush or some shit. I'm looking for someone who's going to be Trump, but even more ruthless and competent. And that's really where I critique Trump on these days, where my dissatisfaction of Trump comes from. Is he just got fucking cucked, and he didn't do anything to these people.
One of the debates on the right has been having a red Caesar come around. And I think one of the things that most people don't understand about history, right, mm-hmm. is we use the term Caesar. And when we use the term Caesar, there's two things you're referring to. You're referring to position, and you're referring to the person. The issue is this. Julius Caesar was a person who ended up, you know, who ended up crossing a Rubicon, as it was, who ended up, you know, wearing red boots, which was specifically a sign of being a king, a monarch. He violated these norms, as it were. He ends up being stabbed to death by Senate. What happens is then his appointed successor, Augustus, appoints himself Caesar, this being a role, and he is the one that actually manages to turn into imperator. He manages to turn into the emperorship of the Roman Empire. It was not Julius Caesar that managed to oversee this. We say Caesar, but people will conflate that with Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar managed to shatter norms. It was Augustus Caesar who watched the violent assassination, never been unprecedented by elites, by senators. And the only reason Julius Caesar did not have bodyguards to stop this was because you couldn't bring anyone that wasn't senator into the Senate. And so that is why he was unarmed, and that is why he was knifed to death. And so Augustus watched all this and said, "Ah, I saw what happened to essentially my stepfather. He was adopted by Julius's legal kind of thing." He said, "Ah, I saw what happened to my adoptive father. I won't make same mistake." And that is where Augustus manages to pull off what Julius failed at. And so issue then is, who is it? Does Donald Trump have enough ability to learn? Or is it someone else watching from the shadows that says, ah, I saw what happened. I won't make the same mistake.
That's a great point. That is a great point. And on that point, I think we will wrap this podcast up. I think this was interesting and cathartic, because it was kind of nice to kind of, you know, start to wrestle with Trump's legacy and the potential implications. So, well, thanks for joining us today. I am your NPR podcast host of the Contextual Insurgent Project, Aaron Smith, and I have been joined by Tech Bro Tito. Go ahead.
Nostruvia.